Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, the think tank in Brussels. And in today's director's cut, I'm joined by Tarman Shanmugaratnam and Jean Pisani-Ferry. Tarman is the deputy prime minister of Singapore and Jean is obviously a Bruegel senior fellow. And Tarman, welcome to both of you, first of all.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Tarman, you've just been heading a report, a group of eminent persons, G20 eminent persons group on global financial governance. And you have just published here in October a report called Making the Global Financial System Work for All. That's a great title. And I'm sure our readers would love to learn from you what are the key insights of this report.
Well, thanks very much, Guntram. So let me summarize the thrust of it. It was a collective enterprise of 16 of us on the Eminent Persons Group. I should just say straight off that the fact that 16 people with minds of their own and from very diverse backgrounds managed to agree very wholeheartedly on a set of propositions, a set of premises and a set of propositions illustrated how important this is and illustrated the fact that regardless of where we come from, regardless of our backgrounds, we are agreed that first, our current system, our current international monetary and financial system is not fitted out for the future. And second, very importantly, agreed that there is a way forward that is practical and doable. When I say it's not fitted out for the future, what I mean is that it's not going to achieve the fundamental growth and development objectives that the system must aim to achieve. And it's also not achieving the financial stability objectives of the system. And we have to realize that the task ahead in the next decade is of an entirely different scale from what we've seen in the past. If you look at the demographics of the developing world, it is clear that what we have to deliver in the next decade is of an altogether different magnitude. And the consequences of failure in Africa, for instance, will clearly be not merely economic. We must succeed. We must succeed in Africa. We must succeed in development and in arresting the deterioration of the global commons in the next decade. And the current system requires a fundamental reorganization and rearrangement for us to achieve it. We also know that financial stability is still elusive. Clearly, there have been very significant improvements since the last crisis, particularly on prudential regulation and particularly with regard to the banks. But we know that the risks have grown outside of the banking system. And importantly, when it comes to individual countries, particularly in the emerging world, we still have recurring bouts of instability that impair growth. They impair the reform process and they impair growth. So all is not well, but the system is not completely broken. With determined efforts at achieving a new coherence, with efforts to plug the gaps, we can actually lay the foundations for a new phase in cooperative internationalism. That is not simply an attempt to replicate the old multilateralism. That's basically our objective. And our aim was to produce a set of specific proposals. There are, in fact, 22 of them that are workable and doable within a period of years. So I think I'll just stop there.
Yeah, thank you, Tarman, for this first overview. Of course, I immediately have a number of questions. I mean, so by looking, first of all, at the group of authors and the very diverse set of personalities and characters, it's of course very impressive to hear that they all could quite easily agree on the set of recommendations you put forward, and you emphasize very much Africa, you emphasized the need for better prudential banking regulation, or you said that a lot has been done there. So I guess what I was wondering, where do you see really still the main problems related to the stability of the financial system so that the financial system delivers? I mean, the emerging market economies, of course, are currently somewhat under stress depending on their fundamentals. But more broadly, I mean, where do you see the financial system really being a source of trouble going ahead?
Well, first I'd say, you know, what's happening today is somewhat different from what happened in the global financial crisis. In the global financial crisis, we had something that happened to everyone at the same time. It was global. There was a major setback. There was a recession that affected many countries at the same time. And there was financial instability that was across the world. What we are seeing today is a erosion of growth by stealth, one country at a time, one liquidity squeeze at a time, one episode at a time. And when you accumulate it, it is actually a significant reduction in cumulative growth across the emerging world, especially. And that's important because the cycle will eventually turn. It'll eventually turn in the United States, and we'll find that we don't have the alternative engines of growth in the world economy. So that's one part of the problem. And that's one reason why we shouldn't view the current episodes as idiosyncratic due to policy errors in one country or another, but we should recognize that something systematic is still there in the system, that the smallest of changes in interest rate policy in the large advanced economies has repercussions around the world. And the structure of the financial markets is still such that there is a very significant risk on, risk off movement. It causes instability and volatility, and it forces countries to do things that hamper growth. So when we talk about the buffers that is very sensibly advised to, you know, emerging countries, what are these buffers? These buffers are buffers that reduce growth. It either means you tighten monetary or fiscal policy beyond what is required for domestic balance reasons, or it means you build up self-insurance so that you don't end up in the same position as someone else did that you see before you. Or it means basically that we have to curtail the free movement of capital one way or another. And all these things have a cost in terms of growth. So the spillovers that are inherent in an interconnected world, not because of policy mistakes in the advanced world. In fact, the central banks or authorities in the advanced world can be making the right decisions from a domestic point of view, but it's in the nature of a highly interconnected system that can constrain the policy space in other countries. And in fact, it can lead to growth-reducing policy options being pursued. And we have to accept that is systematic. That's part and parcel of an interconnected world. And it means you need a much more robust global financial safety net. But it also means that over time, we've got to develop stronger norms that reduce the scale and frequency of spillovers.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps let me turn now to Jean to react to some of what we heard. Of course, one interesting aspect, Jean, is of course that we have a global financial system, we have a global financial cycle, and we have a global financial safety net. Yet we are also seeing regional financial safety nets being built up. I mean, that perhaps is something to reflect on going forward.
Yes, I think what's most original in the report is not the very accurate description of the challenges. It's the fact that for perhaps the first time, a report of this sort says, we're not going to go back to the old Bretton Woods system. We're not going to strengthen only the Bretton Woods institution, the IMF and the World Bank. And we're already in a different world. We're in a world where the functioning is much more of a network type with several institutions, a combination of multilateral, regional, bilateral, and national types of safety nets or initiatives. And that the problem really is to find the proper way of coordinating, of making, as the report says, the system work as a system, being known that we're not going to return to this old world where we had one set of issues, one treaty, one institution based on this treaty, and a set of instruments that was in the hand of the institution. That's gone. And there is a very interesting graph in the report that compares the global financial safety nets in 2006 and 2016. Obviously, they have enlarged significantly, and there are various ways of defining them. But the way they're defined in the report, the IMF represented, the IMF permanent resources amounted for 3/4 of the total in 2006. They now amount to 15%. So this is a fundamental change. And the report, again, does not call, and perhaps it's not by lack of nostalgia, because, you know, there would be strong argument for going back to a system that would be more centralized around institutions. So the system, the report does not call for that. It calls for new ways of organizing this coordination and interdependence between different type of instrument and institutions.
Well, Taman, can I ask you on this point and push you a little bit more on this point? So we've just heard that your report says actually only 15% of the resources available for global insurance come now from the IMF. So the regional ones, such as the European Stability Mechanism, but also, of course, a number of mechanisms in Asia, have gained in strength. I mean, is your report in the end saying that the IMF has become less important?
It has become less important in terms of its share of what is, I think, euphemistically called a global financial safety net. But it has to become more important, and that's a very important point in the report. Much of what appears under the in this aggregation that we call a global financial safety net is untested in crisis. It is also highly uneven across countries, and in particular, there's a whole range of systemically significant countries in South Asia and Latin America and in sub-Saharan Africa, who are not covered by regional financial arrangements. The system is even in its regional parts of quite different degrees of coherence. I think the ESM is very different from the other entities. So really what we have is a bit of patchwork. It is, I think, far too optimistic to assume that in a crisis that somehow or rather the patchwork functions as a system and you truly have this very large global financial safety net. There's no escaping the fact that you need a stronger global core at the IMF. And that means both the permanent resources of the IMF as well as some way in which the IMF can amass very quickly at short notice additional resources when you get a systemic crisis of a tail risk nature. There's no escaping that. But under all conceivable scenarios, we also have to make much better the current system of regional arrangements by tying them together with the IMF. And that is not awfully complex work. You can devise a system of protocols depending on the nature of the crisis, whether it's a short-term liquidity crisis or something more than that. You can really devise entry eligibility criteria for countries that allows regional financial arrangements and the IMF to act jointly or to at least act in concert. You can really tie up the system a lot better. So I think those are two very important tasks. The first is traditional. You've got to strengthen the global core. the true global multilateral core. But the second accepts the world as it is and says, how can we make the system operate as a system? And it means you've got to tie together the regional pieces with the IMF in a more effective and predictable way. And again, if you don't do this, there's a cost. There'll be a cost to growth because countries will be forced to self-insure, and they'll be forced each time a crisis hits to engage in growth-reducing policy actions. And we all suffer from that cost at the end of the day.
Draman, you said that the ESM is probably, and I agree with that, the most advanced, and because it is the one that has been tested among the regional financial arrangements and tested with very severe crisis. Nevertheless, the collaboration with the IMF has not always been easy, in spite of a lot of goodwill and a clear political decision by the Europeans that they wanted to have the IMF in. As regard the conditionality of the programs, as regard the evaluation of debt sustainability, as regards, then after the length and the fiscal stance that would have to be applied, there were significant differences and they were hard to solve. So do you have in mind something that would give more authority to the IMF in spite of the IMF in such situation providing the smaller share of financial resources?
Well, I would say a lot of the problems we've seen were the problems that came out of one episode, and particularly because of one country. And it was a very unfortunate episode. And we should try not to abstract too much from that when devising
the principles. There were also disagreements on Ireland of a different nature.
Well, I would say
significant disagreements on Ireland in the treatment of bank creditors.
Yeah, well, there were differences of view, and it is probably healthy to have some difference in perspective from the point of on the part of the global policeman and the regional policeman. I think that would be healthy. Inherent in being very close to the action, either as a neighboring country or as a group of neighbors, is that you will tend to go with a solution that doesn't push things too far immediately. And that's been the case historically everywhere. But I would say as a generalization that, and I'm speaking here from a distance, and it's really not don't misunderstand me, this is not my business, but I would say, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, all worked fairly well in terms of that compound of IMF and European thinking and actions worked fairly well. Greece was different. So the role of the IMF in being part of program design, well, firstly, assessment of the situation, and secondly, being part of program design is, I think, a stabilizing force in the long term. And my reading of things is that 1 year on from the very very clear disagreements a year ago, there's a much better understanding between the ESM and the IMF and the various parties.
Well, I would probably agree that the IMF played an important role in the European context and helped prevent some of the worst decisions. At the same time, I have to say I have written on this together. I have to underline that differences in policy views were quite substantial, and the result was, in some instances at least, the lowest common denominator instead of the best possible solutions. So I think I guess one can say when an international and a regional institution work together, there's pluses and minuses. But I don't want this conversation to just be about Europe. So I'd like to ask you a little bit more, Taman, on the first point you made as regards strengthening the core and strengthening the multilateral core. So in other words, the IMF. The IMF as a Bretton Woods institution is, of course, an institution that has been and still is very much dominated by the United States and the European countries. We are the biggest shareholders, and any attempt to change majorities and change quotas is fiercely resisted, and has been fiercely resisted especially by U.S. policymakers, U.S. Senate, and so on. So now, when saying you think the core needs to be strengthened, there needs to be more capital available in the core. What do you have in mind? Do you have in mind that emerging economies or China should be bigger shareholders of the fund and correspondingly get higher voting rights, or what do you have in mind?
Well, I would say for both the IMF as well as the multilateral development banks generally, there will have to be periodic strengthening of their capital resources. It was, by the way, specifically not part of the mandate of the Eminent Persons Group to make recommendations on quota increases and capital increases and the restructuring of capital, but we did make a very clear observation that the system requires a strong core. On development finance, there's a very important catalytic role that's played by the multilateral development banks, and we can't expect private capital to be mobilized without that very strong core and that very strong catalyst. And it does require capital. It does require risk capital. On the IMF side, as we've just discussed, the global financial safety net requires a strong global core. And that does mean permanent resources going up. And naturally, permanent resources, each time they're revised, will be revised with somewhat different shares on the part of different member states. And it's a well-accepted principle that the faster-growing emerging economies, who are now becoming a more important part of the global system, will get more larger shares over time. But we don't make specific recommendations on it, because there are other G20 groups that are working on that, and the IMF itself, under the IMFC, is working on it. But it's not contentious that we say that. Not at all contentious.
Can I address another topic, which is prominent in your report, which is the multilateral development banks? And here we've seen the transformation of the architecture, because we have seen the burgeoning of new institutions. And we've seen also a very major initiative with China's Belt and Road Initiative. So what you're observing is that the needs are considerable, if only because of the problem of demography, of environmental issues. There are very significant investment needs. And you have a sort of collection of institutions that more or less fulfill the same role and that are relatively loosely coordinated. So you're putting forward this idea of country development platforms, which is basically on a country-by-country basis to sort of draw on the various possible instruments to address the priorities that are relevant for a particular country. Could you say a bit more on that?
Yeah, thanks. That's a very useful point. I would say what's happened in terms of the emergence of new institutions is not incidental. It reflects the fact that we have a more multipolar world. There are a lot of pluses in it. There's additional resources being brought to bear. There's a certain speed to market that's been quite clear as well. But what we need to achieve is much more coherence and complementarity now between the different institutions, the different development finance institutions. Mm-hmm. And that means, importantly, not just the multilateral players, which means the World Bank and the regional development banks and some of the new banks, but also the bilateral players, who are in fact now larger than the multilateral players collectively. And having the bilateral players and multilateral players working on a level playing field of standards, whether it's standards to do with debt sustainability or environmental standards or you know, very obvious things to do with corruption and so on, is absolutely critical. Because once you agree on core standards, then you have a healthy competition around other issues, innovation, ability to bring more projects through the pipeline and to originate more projects, working more effectively with governments to be able to improve regulation and so on and so forth, rather than zero-sum competition. And what we've really got to achieve is that you now have more institutions, more resources being brought to bear, with you know some ingenuity in some cases, but it's got to be a system where the whole is larger than the sum of the parts. And currently, you have a mix of healthy and zero sum competition, and it's really very importantly, it's not going to be able to mobilize private capital, because unless you have coherence on the part of the global public sector, you're not going to be able to mobilize private capital on the scale required. We have to jointly mitigate risk, and that means jointly working on improving governance and governance capacity, jointly mitigating project risk, but jointly de-risking the whole environment in some developing countries, helping them to de-risk the whole environment in order to mobilize private capital. And we are very far away from our objectives being achieved today. If you look at the scale of private capital required compared to what's actually flowing in, we are very far away from being achieved. And there has to be a sense of urgency about organizing development differently from the past.
Well, that's of course a very, very important discussion. And if I think back at the last couple of years where China has become a much more assertive bilateral donor in a number of countries, in particular in the One Belt and One Road context, there have been a lot of calls for more transparency, more clarity on the size of the funding, the kind of guarantees, and so on and so forth. Because indeed, as a private investor into a country in which China has made major investments in the context of One Belt and One Road, there's often quite significant doubts about priorities of creditors, clarity on what rules govern these credits, and so on and so forth. Meanwhile, I think the US also has stepped up and increased some of its bilateral facilities for African countries. So it seems as if we were moving away from a world in which sort of the multilateral institutions, the World Bank, but also the regional institutions are the key players, and the more it becomes more and more a messy world where bilateral lenders increasingly play roles, especially in countries that are considered strategic, leading to more not less uncertainty for private investors. Was that a shared feeling among the members of the group? Or,
well, I'd say it is a shared feeling that there is currently a lack of coherence. And there's some competition between different players that doesn't really add to the whole. It just means a zero-sum game. But I'd say that there's been near uniform support for this proposal. And that the largest bilateral players have been, in fact, supportive of this proposal, that we should agree on core standards, we should achieve some complementarity between the different players, and we should really raise the whole game that way. We haven't received any pushback on that issue. In fact, there's been a very strong keenness to get going with this new way of organizing development. So I would be hopeful. Going forward, I'd be hopeful that we'd get a much better working arrangement between the bilaterals and the multilaterals, and between the different multilateral players as well.
wonderful. I think we've covered a lot of ground in the last 30 minutes. Of course, we could go on for another half an hour easily, but I think for the purposes of this podcast, let me thank you, Tharman Shanmugaratnam, Deputy Prime Minister from Singapore, and Jean Pisani, Senior Fellow at Bruegel. Thank you to both of you for having done this podcast with me today.